Hi, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Ruchama Bistritsky Klantman. I'm the founder and the executive director of MASC, Mothers and Fathers Aligned Saving Kids. I'd like to invite you to tune in to my weekly radio show starting next Thursday evening from 9 to 10 p.m. We're going to be talking about family matters, dealing with family issues, every Thursday night from 9 to 10 over WSNR 620 a.m. You can also catch it on talklinecommunications.com. I'm inviting all the listeners to please listen in, and you're welcome to email me any questions or any topics that you would like to speak about on our show. You can email me at Ruchama, R-U-C-H-A-M as in Mary, A, at MASC, M-A-S-K, parents, P-A-R-E-N-T-S, .org. Looking forward. Thank you. Good evening and welcome back to MASC's weekly radio show on family matters. MASC, Mothers and Fathers Align, Saving Kids, kids with all issues, whether it's mental health or addiction, school issues, feel free to call anonymously. Our confidential helpline for referrals, support groups, yeshiva liaison. Maybe you need an outpatient clinic, an inpatient facility for addiction, for gambling. If you know somebody that may need a referral, feel free to give them our number, and that is 718-758-0400. We also do trainings on naloxone, which is prevention of opioid overdose. So it is an inhaler, and if somebody wants to get trained and get a free naloxone kit, feel free to call us. Again, I'll repeat our number. Maybe it's for yourself, loved one, a child. Maybe it's for your spouse, a neighbor, or someone you sit next to in shul. Jot down our number. It is 718-758-0400. Feel free to call us 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Tonight's show is a very, very important show. I think every one of our shows are important, but it is important because the topic is anxiety, and I know anxiety is on the rise on helpline calls. From when I started MASC was drugs and alcohol, gambling, and now many 23 years, we're going to be coming up to in February, starting our 23rd year doing this. And I must say that the last 5 years, a very large percentage of our calls are only about anxiety. And we will be talking more about this topic with the world-famous Dr. Michael Portman, who is a clinical psychologist and an expert and supervisor in CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. He's an international authority on generalized anxiety disorder. And I'd like to welcome you on tonight. Thank you for making the time for being here with us. Thank you. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me. And I appreciate all the work that MASC does for the CLAL. It's the tremendous work that you're doing.
Thank you. And it's so important that we have professionals come onto my radio show every week and talk about these different mental health issues that affect families one way or another, whether it's anxiety, whether it's eating disorder, whether it's addictions, gambling, internet addiction. There's so many mental health issues that are affecting so many families today, and it's so important to put the information out there. But more important is to offer solutions, not just talk about the issues, but actually to offer solutions. And that's why I wanted to have you on tonight, Dr. Portman, because you being an expert in cognitive behavioral therapy is one solution for many. So I'd like you, for our listeners, if you could please explain first, what is cognitive behavioral therapy?
Well, cognitive behavioral therapy is an evidence-based therapeutic theory and treatment approach to a variety of disorders. It was founded by Dr. Aaron Beck almost 45 years ago. It's very pragmatic. When I mean evidence-based, that there's a lot of data to support it. We work collaboratively with the individuals we take care of. It's very structured. We give homework assignments. We're focusing on trying to help people change the way they appraise things, the way they look at the world. If there's non-adaptive behaviors going on, we try to help them think about other more pro-social, you know, better options in terms of facing. But it's a very rational, practical, collaborative interactive, generally short-term, not always, but it's, we pride ourselves less on awareness and more on practical solutions to everyday problems people are facing.
Well, I just want to stress that anxiety disorder can come in many different ways. You've been working for 15 years with veterans and with many different general anxiety across the lifespan of many different programs, whether it's publications that you've been, written up about. And I'm wondering if you can specify about anxiety in general. I mean, there's panic disorder and there's phobias and there's general anxiety. Can you talk about the different kinds of anxiety first, please?
Sure. So there's been a lot of changes with the diagnostic, criteria for anxiety conditions. And at this point, some of them have actually been moved into different, categories, and no longer, PTSD is no longer considered an anxiety disorder, even though I feel anxiety is at the root of it. But in terms of the main anxiety disorders, the ones that, I treat and, seem to be the most common, generalized anxiety disorder is one, where there's a lot of chronic anxiety and worry. There's social anxiety disorder where individuals are more avoidant and they're worried about the scrutiny or needing the validation of others. There's panic disorder, which is different than generalized anxiety disorder because it's more discrete episodes of heightened anxiety that kind of comes on where people feel like almost they have to run to the emergency room. They get a lot of physical symptoms often. There's specific phobias, which is considered an anxiety disorder, where people are just phobic about a particular thing, like fear of flying, fear of speaking. Obsessive compulsive disorder is no longer considered an anxiety disorder, which, there's a lot of debate about, but that's where there's the presence of obsessions. People are, ruminating, going over and over things in their mind, and then they do compulsive behaviors to hope to sort of neutralize, to get rid of the distress from the obsessions, which only worked in the short run. So those are probably the basic anxiety disorders, but GD is often considered kind of the basic one, the most prevalent one, and the one, that I tend to treat the most, but I do, treat the other ones as well. But those are really the main ones.
So just for my listeners, GAD is general anxiety disorder, which you just mentioned.
Right.
GAD, I want everyone to understand what we're speaking about. So is anxiety inherited, or is it learned, or is it both?
I would say it's both. I mean, statistics seem to point to about a 30 to 35% inheritability. Panic disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder, even though OCD is no longer really considered in the anxiety framework, even though most of us still consider it an anxiety disorder, those may have a little bit more genetic leaning. Generalized anxiety disorder for many years was considered not inheritable, but there's been more research that it does tend to run in families. So it's both nature and nurture. I mean, definitely there is a genetic leaning toward these. They run in families, But stressors and traumas and, you know, life challenges will definitely determine, contribute as to whether someone will actually develop an anxiety disorder or not. So the environment and a lot of other factors do play a role, not just genetics.
I know on our hotline, I know we get families that are calling here every day. I mean every day, no exaggeration, about children themselves, their spouses suffering from different anxiety disorders like you mentioned, whether it's depression, whether it's panic disorders, whether it's stress and anger management, whatever it's coming from. But when we ask about is there any anxiety in the family, more often than not, they say yes. That a parent, mother-in-law, father-in-law themselves, you know, mother, father, do have anxiety. So nature, nurture, yeah, I'm imagining that it's both. And I'm wondering, how does it differ, cognitive behavioral therapy, from other psychological therapies?
Well, I think CBT's emphasis is more pragmatic and rational and, you know, less on overanalyzing the past. It's a more present-oriented. So it's not that if the past is being brought into the present when we're, you know, dealing with people with anxiety or other types of psychological conditions, we do address those things. But we focus more on the here and now and trying to give people practical solutions for being more in the present moment. Mindfulness has become a very big part of cognitive behavioral therapy, too. So I'd say we're more structured. We do, you know, have more of a focus on homework assignments. We try to weigh the evidence of people's thoughts. So it tends to be less insight oriented and more, like I had mentioned, not to be ad nauseum, more pragmatic, structured, problem solving. I think that's our strength. We're interested in people feeling better, not just having more awareness about what's going on. So I'd say that's where it's different than many of the other approaches.
And do sometimes the individuals suffering with anxiety start with CBT and then get strong enough to move on to other psychological therapies in addition?
Yeah, that's not uncommon. I was trained, you know, initially as an analyst, more Freudian, so I think that integration does take place a lot where people will do, you know, a CBT. They'll do 8 to 12 sessions of CBT. And if, you know, it's not that CBT can't go deeper and deal with things, but I think, you know, having had a psychodynamic background myself and some of my other colleagues, I think there's a strength in clinicians who are trained in more than one modality. So my primary modality is CBT, and, you know, many of my colleagues who are trained in CBT are only trained in CBT. I'm not saying it's a disadvantage or advantage. If CBT is done well, sometimes that can totally resolve the problem with having to do any other approach. But oftentimes either medication, which is a modality, can be added, or some people want to move into more processing like psychodynamic therapy or any of the number of other, you know, empirically supported treatments. So yes, combination approaches do sometimes occur with people. I think it's just on an individual basis. It's not one size fits all.
I'm just wondering, I know that you've worked over, you know, 15, 20 years in many different areas, like I said, across the lifespan of anxiety. And I'm wondering if you can just share with us what got you interested in general anxiety disorder.
Well, I think I'm raised from a family who believes in helping the underdog, and GAD is a really misunderstood diagnosis because you really can't see it. You know, it's people worrying, you know, kind of, some people have called it the invisible disorder, silent sufferers. Many times they were called the worried well, people that don't need to really be worried about anything. So I think, you know, that underdog in my family mentality, and also I found myself, you know, starting just to write about it in graduate school and then sort of continued to be interested in it. It's been neglected, it's undertreated, it's misunderstood. And I think there's sort of an inherent appeal to that for me to try to help individuals that are not being, you know, treated as adequately or successfully where a lot of the other conditions are either better known, better treated. So I think, you know, it's like sort of that, you know, rooting for the underdog. And plus, I just feel it's so prevalent and so much more debilitating than people think that it kind of was a calling. You know, I just felt sort of called to it. And now I've become very passionate about, you know, trying to help people that are chronically anxious and worried. So it started way back in graduate school.
Wow. And I know you've researched, you were a guest editor with
Psychiatric Annals. Yeah.
Right. So I know you're a lead expert and author on this. So let's talk about what are some practical strategies for treating general anxiety disorder?
Well, there are a lot of different approaches. I mean, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, tends to be the most effective approach. But if we look at certain strategies, such as having people, you know, look at their thoughts, weigh the evidence, you know, monitor their thoughts, especially with individuals that are worried, sometimes a very successful treatment approach is to have them postpone worry or schedule worry for a certain period of time. Like for 10, 15 minutes a day, you're going to worry. And then when you start worrying again, you kind of like go back just to that time. Helping people take action rather than worry. Also normalizing that anxiety is really part of the human condition. So there are a lot of acceptance-based approaches to it. So instead of having someone fight it, if they embrace it and try to be like more in the moment. So mindfulness approach is helping people, because anxiety is really about a future-oriented threat that's very unlikely to occur. So we try to bring people back to the moment, helping people tolerate uncertainty and ambiguity, because all we have control in our life is the effort, not the outcome. I mentioned problem solving, you know, building structures, you know, infrastructures in their life, like friends, family. You know, there's research that, you know, therapy and medication is helpful, but the more support systems people have, I also encourage exercise, self-care, self-compassion. You know, it's an overall holistic approach to treating anxiety. Exercise has, you know, been more studied in depression, but there's more and more research that exercise, even if it's 15 minutes, 2-3 times a week, can, you know, take the edge off anxiety as well. So there's a lot of different things we can do now. And even in GAD in particular, there are 7 or 8 different models being, you know, developed and, you know, further researched to help people, you know, regulate the anxiety, which can be so debilitating in their lives.
And generally, how long, I'm imagining generally shouldn't be the word, but how long does treatment last for anxiety, in particular for general anxiety disorder?
I think it
depends. No two patients right. that are the same by you, right?
So, right, exactly, exactly.
Right. So I don't mean generally, but...
Yeah, so I think for all the anxiety disorders, and I would say this is true really with all the psychological conditions, it really depends on the intensity, duration, how impaired the person is, you know, how much, you know, genetic loading there is in the family, you know, how long they've had it, the therapeutic relationship they have, you know, can, you know, accelerate treatment if it's a really good one. Whether individuals are compliant with treatment. So I always tell individuals, you know, you have to do the work, and we can provide as clinicians the guidance, the structure, but the work. So I think, you know, it's not to place the entire onus on the person who's in treatment, but I think the more compliant the person is and the more eager they are to get better and the more hope the clinician can build, plus that building of that trust in that relationship, that accelerates it. So therapy can be, you know, 8 to 10 sessions, and for some people it can, you know, last, you know, a long time. It can sometimes be 6 months to a year. I think it really just depends on so many contextual factors. Most of the research that's been done on undergraduates, you know, CBT, that are healthier, so the protocols tend to be 8 to 16 sessions. I think most people probably are in treatment more like 3 to 6 months, which is relatively short term compared to, you know, a lot, some of the other approaches, which can be, you know, years of people being in therapy, sometimes even multiple times a week.
Now, you said about exercising, how important it is, even 15 minutes a day. But people that have anxiety, whether they have social anxiety disorder or other issues that they're struggling with, wouldn't, you know, going to a gym, for instance, if they have social anxiety, that may be giving them anxiety too.
That's true, but the thing is, if that can incrementally be done, that's a form of exposure, which is a treatment for anxiety. So if we can get a socially anxious person in the gym, there are two benefits that they can reap from that. One is that they're exposing themselves slowly to what they fear, finding out that the fear is really not as realistic as they think, and on top of it, they're getting the benefits of exercise. So if someone's, you know, very socially anxious, you know, that it may not be the first thing to recommend them go to a gym, but maybe just to exercise, you know, either by themselves at home or with a friend, and then slowly, as you build up the hierarchy of what's anxiety producing to them, the gym might be the next step or the following step, you know, because we don't want people going to the gym if they're socially anxious and becoming more anxious because of the benefits that exercise can bring that would be offset by them feeling more anxious by being around other people. So, you know, we have to be, timing plays a role in terms of, you know, what the strategies we would, you know, implement and whether the person can handle it or not as well. We don't want to cause extreme, you know, increased distress that's going to persist. But there may be some increased anxiety in the treatment of anxiety only for it to go down. We have to sort of get people to realize sometimes anxiety gets increased and it will go down. It will not last more often than not.
What about somebody that, you know, does CBT, does it well? I mean, couldn't they relapse? Couldn't they, you know, go into, you know, like suddenly something comes up in their life and then they need to start it all over again?
It can happen if there are other, you know, stressors come up. And so sometimes I do boosters with individuals. Like I'll see them once there's a successfully completed treatment. You know, I might see them once a month for boosters for 3 months or 6 months so that the gains can be made. So that sometimes is helpful for individuals. There are some very good studies that effective CBT does tend to last. There's been a couple of studies where individuals that have gone through successful CBT, we look at them like a decade later, and many of them are still in remission. So there is some good research to show, some longitudinal data to show that effective CBT, often these individuals do not have to come back to treatment if it's done correctly and the issue's been taken care of. But it's true if stressors or traumas or losses, that would be true for any type of therapy, that sometimes people need to come back for, you know, maybe not another round, but just, you know, some encouragement, support, some problem-solving strategies. So, you know, I do find that in my practice. I've seen somebody, and then they come back for 2-3 more sessions, or, you know, we add some other, like, strategies to prevent, you know, future recurrences. But recurrences can happen not just in anxiety. It can happen in any of the psychological conditions requiring more treatment. So that does occur. That's a good question.
I'm just wondering, some people don't like the idea of going to therapy. So what would you say now to parents that are listening whose family members are suffering with anxiety, who they don't want to go to therapy thinking that therapy means talking about everything going on in their life? So can you give the parents that are listening some of the words, some of the language that they could share with their loved one about going to get CBT therapy, not regular psychological therapy?
Well, I think it's, you know, just being supportive, and, you know, if there's if one heart speaks to the other heart, it's often heard no matter what the age is. So if I think a parent is genuinely compassionate and shows concern and will say to, you know, either a child or an adolescent, you know, we're concerned about you and, you know, we've heard of this type of treatment that's very practical, it doesn't require a lot of analysis, it'll help you, you know, build some skills for life, you know, kind of like taking piano lessons, you know, you get better the more you take them. So, you know, CBT could be viewed in kind of that light to sort of normalize it as not being like heavy-duty therapy, but more practical, you know, problem-solving, you know, building social skills. It just might normalize it using a language that doesn't make it sound so therapeutic. Because you're right, there are individuals that are very sensitive to the idea of psychotherapy and feeling the stigma involved with it. So I think if the language is softer and use it, this is going to help optimize your potential. And it's a lot like, you know, working out and, you know, building muscle strength. You're building, you know, cognitive strength and, you know, your behaviors will be healthier and, you know, you'll just feel better. So I think if the language is compassionate and heartfelt, I think people are responsive to that. And CBT also is, you know, very in vogue now and it's been shown to be effective. So I think if you tell someone, whatever their age is, this is a very effective treatment, and it's not long-term, and it's interactive. And so I think, you know, like the language in general, if it's soft and compassionate, I think that will get, you know, individuals into therapy much quicker than, you know, the other types of ways of approaching getting individuals into taking care of themselves.
Thank you. So once again, can you just share what the difference is between the stress, anxiety, worry, perfection, and being obsessive, please? For those that may be
Right. Yeah, those are common. They're commonly like intermingled. Stress is really just a reaction to life. So stress, you know, often requires treatment, but, you know, there are stress management programs, and sometimes even exercise alone will help with stress. So stress is not a clinical diagnosis. It's, you know, stress is something we all face, and, you know, stress and anxiety used to be like the same thing. There used to be a famous book called Stress and Related Conditions, and they put lumped anxiety in there. But stress, you know, is just more a general reaction to life and the challenges. And, you know, a lot of times, like I mentioned, just exercising, talking it out, therapy's often sometimes not even required for it. When we talk about obsessions, it just depends on the degree of them. Sometimes, you know, people are prone to like obsessing about stuff. And, you know, once again, you know, that can be, handled sometimes just through supportive measures as well, whether it's supportive therapy, or not. Perfectionism, once again, stress, perfectionism, and just obsessiveness are not, you know, don't always, you know, warrant treatment. They can sometimes be done in, you know, with self-help, exercise, but anxiety, oftentimes isn't, like I mentioned earlier, intense. It's lasting. It's more impairing. I'm not saying the other things are not as well and may not require treatment, but anxiety itself has, you know, a set types of, or number of criteria that would probably warrant and be less likely to go away with just support and just exercise. So oftentimes, you know, anxiety conditions really do warrant therapy because they're more genetic, there's more loading for them, they tend to last longer, and like I mentioned, they're more impairing. So that's where I think that anxiety would be very different and often needing more management by a professional than the other types of things that we mentioned.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Michael Portman. It's really been very informative. And I hope to have you on again. We're running out of time, so thanks for being on with us tonight.
And thank you again for having me and for all the great work that MASS does for the community. It's
thank you.
It's been an honor to be on the show. Thank you.
Thank you, and I want to wish everybody a very good evening, a beautiful Shabbos. Always remember, hang in. Hold on, hug tight, and our number is 718-758-0400. And I'd just like to add a refuah shlema for Yosef Ben Perel from the anti-Semitic horrible situation that happened in Muncie during Hanukkah. And for all those that are still recuperating, they should have a refuah shlema. Thank you, Dr. Portman. Have a good night.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.